Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our conversation this week is with Paul Franklin from Double Negative about their work on the recent Harry Potter film. And I've always really enjoyed the conversations we've had with Paul because I think he's really forthright about what the work they've done, really has some interesting stories, and this week it's no exception. But before we get to that, I just want to talk about FX Guide TV a bit. Really appreciate the response from everyone. It's really taken off like gangbusters. I just got back from a three-week tour in Asia doing Flame Master classes, and I recorded some interviews with flame artists in Beijing and Seoul and even Mumbai, and we'll be bringing those out in the coming months on FX Guide. But the big thing is, coming up next week, we're going to be doing two-a-day netcasts, a little shorter episodes from Seagraph, covering what's going on at the show. This is made possible in part by the sponsorship of Autodesk. We really appreciate their support to enable us to do these netcasts from Seagraph, as well as the folks over at AWN who've been helping us on a technical standpoint. We really expect a large viewership, so we're doing them a bit differently. They're not going to be distributed in iTunes at HD. They're actually going to be done as streaming Flash videos from our website in AWN. So there'll be a big button, big area up in the upper right-hand corner of FX Guide where the forums block is. Everything's going to shift down. And you'll click on that to get the special media player that's been developed for the Seagraph coverage. Again, we appreciate the support. We'd love to do it in HD. It's just based upon the number of viewers and kind of hits that we're going to get from Seagraph. It's just technically not possible for us. Maybe next year we'll look at doing that. But again, thanks for all the comments regarding FX Guide TV and thanks for your support. Let's go ahead and join the conversation that Mike Seymour had with Paul Franklin. I think you'll enjoy it. It talks a lot about the work and some really interesting stuff regarding the way that the visual effects houses in London work together, which I totally feel is really beneficial for the market. I mean, visiting there, you can see that the various facilities work together in, you know, they're obviously competitors, but they work together to really make a healthy market. So let's go ahead and join the conversation Mike Seymour had with Paul Franklin. Mike?
Thanks for that, John. And thank you very much, Paul, for taking time to talk to us.
It's great to be talking to you, Mike.
So this is some kind of record, both for Harry Potter and I think probably for Double Negative, isn't it? Because you guys did an extraordinary number of shots on this film.
Yeah, it was. It's our biggest show to date. I think in the end we ended up with around 950 completed shots on the film.
Now, what's nice? What's nice is I understand it. You actually had longer than the, you know, sort of 2 or 6 month periods that seem to be the norm these days. You guys were working on this for quite some time.
Yeah, we got involved right at the very beginning of the production. When in fact they were still in pre-production before they'd started shooting. We started developing some tests for some of the creature work that we were later to do on the show, and we got a lot of time with David Yates and with Tim Burke as well. So, yeah, it was a good long time. I think in total we were on the show for about 18 months from beginning to end.
And it's some of the most impressive creature work, isn't it? Because obviously, in this particular film, you were called upon to produce a variety of creatures.
Yes, obviously the kind of jewel in the crown creature-wise was Grawp the Giant, but there was also quite a bit of work with the Patronus creatures in the Room of Requirements during the Patronus lesson.
Well, let's start with the Grawp first, because just to explain, that was something that wasn't possible to be done with the techniques that we use for, say, Hagrid.
No, it wasn't. The idea of Grawp is that he's Hagrid's younger half-brother, and he's a full giant. So Hagrid is a half-giant. He had a human father and a giantess as a mother. So whilst he's big, he's not as big as the full-on giants. So you can use a lot of tricks with Hagrid, a lot of compositing tricks, scale moves, force perspective gags, that sort of thing, to create the sense of Robbie Coltrane being 8 feet tall. But Grawp is 16 feet tall. So he's much, much, much larger than any person could ever be. And also, because he's a full giant, he doesn't look exactly like a human being. He's very recognizable as a person, but his physiognomy is somewhat exaggerated, and you'd be hard-pressed to find an actor that looked like Grawp.
Yeah, the actual lengths of the limbs change in proportion to the torso and the head, don't they? So it's actually not a scaled humanoid necessarily from a strapped person.
That's exactly.
So tell me, how did you go about doing that? Because the character has quite a complex musculature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it was. Right from the very beginning, we realised we had to do Grawp as a fully CG character. And, you know, there have been a lot of really good-looking CG characters in films recently, so, you know, the bar was being set very, very high. And so we started off by doing some tests to first off prove that we could do good-looking skin, that we could do a complex facial rig that would be able to, you know, deliver the emotional performance that David Yates was looking for. And then after that, we started in on a pretty extensive R&D period developing muscle systems, animation rigs, cloth simulations, developing the skin shader to much further than we had done for the tests, because it had to really hold up side by side with real people in shot. There was an awful lot of development work went into putting Grawp together.
So I presume that was subsurface scattering on the skin and stuff?
Yes, there was. We were using single scatter and also multi scatter. To be perfectly honest, it's you know, you could do probably a show in itself just describing all the various things that went into the skin shader. But we felt it was pretty much state of the art in terms of what's been going on recently with various developments in simulating human skin.
Was it something that was pretty much a single pass out of CG, or did you go for a multi-pass solution back through to the compositors?
Well, initially, because the development was very much led by CG, that initially we were generating really just one beauty pass and then a bunch of ID mats to hold out things like the hair and the costume. But as we developed further with the sequence and we got more and more into the lighting and rendering of the sequence, we began to realize there was an awful lot of work that had to be done with manipulating the light within the plates. There was quite a bit of redesign of the lighting of the plates was done after they'd been shot, which obviously all had to be achieved in post, and this very much affected Grawp as well. So in the end, we ended up breaking it down into quite a number of different layers. We would have we'd have a beauty for the skin, but we'd also give separate layers for the shadows, as well as all the various ID mats. And there was quite a lot of work done with things like post-lighting techniques. So we generated normal maps, which would allow us to then relight things to a certain extent within the composite.
And of course, I say of course, but one of the things that helps CG characters is having dirt and dust and, you know, sort of imperfections. And this was particularly the case here, wasn't it? Because it's he's living effectively in a part of the forest. So there's lots of dirt, mud and undergrowth stuff, scratches, etc.
Yes, exactly. We spent a long time first getting the skin right and putting all the detail into the skin. And, you know, we had a wonderfully detailed character, but it didn't really have any sort of history in the environment that that he was in. And, yeah, he's been living in the forest. He's very much a spirit of the forest. He's also, you know, Grawp is like a giant kid. He's like a naughty little boy playing in the bushes and things. So he's covered in bits of mud, dirt of various ages. You know, there's dirt kind of worked into the cracks in his skin and things like that. He's also got various nicks and scratches and cuts from playing around in the bushes. And all of this was developed as a series of extra layers and textures which we added over the top of Grawp. Things like the dirt were actually largely lit, again, in 2D. We would generate mats, holdout mats, where the dirt would go. And then by using the normal maps and various other tricks that we'd come up with, we could actually add all the dirt layers as a composite trick.
Wow, that's interesting.
It was something that we felt was important to do because the Grawp skin shader was so complex and he was pulling so many textures for all the various wrinkles and skin detail that the render times on Grawp were pretty enormous. So if you design the patterns of the dirt and you bake that all into the beauty pass and then you decided you didn't like it after you'd done all that, you didn't want to have to go back and re-render everything again. So it became really very much a necessity to break things down to layers that way.
Now, presumably, in addition to his actual rendering, there was quite a lot of work to do to the background plates to sort of make him feel like he's in the shot. And, of course, his interaction with the other characters, a couple of the characters, for example, picks up. Anything interesting there?
Yeah, well, the sets at Leavesden were really very, very extensive. You know, the Forbidden Forest has been depicted several times in the various Harry Potter films, and every time they build a very, very impressive set on one of the stages at Leavesden. But because Leavesden is actually an old jet engine factory, it's an old Rolls-Royce jet engine factory that dates back, I think, to the 1930s originally, it doesn't have the ceiling height that you might normally expect to get on a modern soundstage. So the sets all tend to top out at about 23, 25 feet up, and then you're just looking up into the reds at that point. The problem with that is that you can build these huge sets, but you're always into doing set extensions. So the trees went up about 23 feet, and then we had to extend them the rest of the way to take them up to the full 300-foot height that we're supposed to have in the Forbidden Forest. One of the big problems with the trees, or one of the big challenges, should I say, is that because the reds are so close, you know, the ceiling is so low, that the lighting rigs are right on top of the actual set. So you really only got about 10 or 15 feet of decent lighting on the trees before you get into stuff where the light sources are so close to the trees that they're burning out and you really can't use that. So you're not just extending it from 23 feet up, you're really doing it from about 10 foot up.
Hmm. And in that Forbidden Forest, there was also a couple of horse-type creatures that were sort of either new or revamped for this film, weren't there?
Yes, those are the centaurs. They were handled by Framestore CFC, so we shared the work on the sequence where you see Grawp and the centaurs in the same shot.
And there were some other, you mentioned earlier, CG characters that were when the army was being formed and they were practicing their spells.
Yes, that's the Patronus creatures. The Patronus spell is something that we'd seen before in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Where Harry casts his spell, which basically consists of a big cone of white light, and then a creature comes out of it. In the case of Harry, it's a stag, which is his Patronus. And the idea is that the creature represents something of the personality of the person who's casting the spell. It's a defensive spell. For the Order of the Phoenix, David Yates and Tim Burke were quite keen to redesign the Patronus because it plays quite a big part in this extended sequence inside the Room of Requirements. And part of that was also developing the animation for several different creatures. There were, I think, in total, four different creatures. There's a dog, a hare, a horse, and an otter. And then also you see various Patronus effects, which are more just visual effects animations, or partially formed Patronuses.
And the way that the Harry Potter films have evolved, do you find that that's a common problem, that you start with something that's quite well known from an earlier film and it has to be either redesigned or modernised?
Well, I guess, you know, they're always looking to push the envelope and provide something that's interesting and exciting to look at. So, you know, which is as you would expect with any kind of large effect-heavy film. You know, you want to give kind of new kind of visual thrrills each time. So yeah, there's a lot of legacy from the earlier films, but they're always constantly evolving. I mean, if you think of the way that the last two, three films have looked compared to the first film, you know, it's a very different interpretation of the whole world and universe of Harry Potter. And I think that also partly reflects the way character developed and the stories have developed as well.
Yeah, because I was moving around to Hogwarts itself, which has become progressively, I guess, more interesting in its actual sort of architectural depiction. It's become sort of considerably more complex, and to a certain extent, the surrounding area of Hogwarts has become more interesting. And you of course, revisited Hogwarts for its external stuff, as well as, of course, some of the interior things, as you mentioned, the Room of Requirements and stuff. But how is it? How is Hogwarts looking in this film?
Well, Hogwarts, there have been subtle changes made to Hogwarts. Stuart Craig made some changes to the big miniature that's used, increasing the height of some of the towers, giving it a more jagged profile, which David Yates was keen to use to sort of symbolise the somewhat more dangerous, edgy nature of the new of the story in the new film. And there was one moment in particular where we have Harry is having his occlumency lessons with Professor Snape, and he's inside Snape's office. Snape casts the spell at Harry, and we fly back from Harry's head, pull through the window, and then the camera ascends the side of the tower and eventually ends up hundreds of feet above Hogwarts, looking down at the jagged towers, which looked like sort of almost like a mouthful of broken teeth, I think was one of the ideas, that it's a sort of spiky, antagonistic image, which symbolises the state of Harry's mind and this sort of unease that he's feeling about the whole situation in the new story. And so that's, as I say, that's reflected in the design changes that are made to Hogwarts. The landscape around Hogwarts, as you say, continually changes and evolves. It always has this sort of Scottish Highland theme to it, but it's always subtly different each time. Again, I think it's designed to reflect the nature of the story to a certain extent.
Yeah, because the story in this time, we've actually got a more sinister plotline, in the sense that, you know, Harry's gone from being the darling boy to the one that's accused almost, and yes. And of course we also have the really quite dramatic scenes with the Death Eaters. Uh-huh. Tell me about that and how you sort of worked up the particle systems around that.
Well, the Death Eaters, I guess they all start out of the character animation pipeline that was put together for Grawp and also the Patronus creatures, because at the core of all the Death Eater effects is always a digital stunt double animation. In some cases, you won't actually see that stunt double in the final effect. It'll be completely replaced with visual effects animation. In some cases, you do. But the visual effects animation, the boiling trails of smoke and cloth and ribbons and things, they always derive from an underlying creature character animation that's put together by our animation crew. The Death Eaters themselves, the actual look of the Death Eaters, follows on from the work that we did on Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, the last film. And I guess this comes back to this idea of, you know, working legacy of what had been designed for previous film and then taking it on the stage further. In Goblet of Fire, we established this idea that the Death Eaters, when they apparate, which is this wizarding way of teleporting from one location to another, when they apparate, they appear in these sort of boiling columns of black, thick, toxic-looking smoke, and then the smoke is quickly absorbed into the forming figure. The figure coalesces out of the smoke, as it were. And that was thought to be quite successful, so the idea was to take it further and actually make it much more part of the whole Death Eater's character, particularly when they're fighting in the battles. You know, so you'd actually see them travelling through the air in this sort of partially materialised smoky form. So we took a lot of the things that we did last time, which is using Maya Fluid Dynamics and our own proprietary volumetric rendering tool set called DNB. We used those tools, again, to create the core of the effect, which is this sort of boiling trail of smoke. But to that, we also added soft body animation, which we created in Houdini, which was perhaps the biggest new thing for us in our visual effects pipeline this time around on this movie. Was Houdini is not a tool that we've never used it before, and we built quite a substantial Houdini pipeline to actually be able to do the soft body work, both in the Death Eaters and also in the Patronus effect that we were talking about earlier on, which The Patronus creatures leave these sort of trails behind them, and that's all Houdini soft bodies again. So you start with the animation of the underlying creature, or in this case the stunt double, which is animated in Maya. That is then exported to Houdini. From that we generate the soft bodies, which are these long flowing ribbons. We're also generating the fluid dynamics in Maya. There's quite a lot of work was done to actually integrate the soft bodies and the fluid dynamics, so that the soft bodies actually also pay attention to what the fluid dynamics are actually doing. The whole lot is then taken back into Maya, and we render the various passes out through a combination of work in RenderMan and DNB and the various different layers. There's smoke, there's the ribbons, as we call them, which if you imagine that the Death Eaters, as they're flying, they almost become like mummies that are unravelling a little bit.
Right.
And these things are then all rendered with holdouts and everything so that they can then be combined and composite. But one of the things that was a real trick was, whilst they really liked this whole idea of these extra tendrils and threads, which made the made it more than just smoke, we had to be careful that they didn't end up looking like the Dementors, which of course can be, you know, could be very, very similar, because these are sort of floating figures that leave these trails of ragged cloth behind them. So it was always a bit of a trick to tune it just right, so you're getting a read on all the stuff that's going on inside there, but it didn't end up looking like a Dementor confusing the audience as to what was actually going on.
And the Houdini stuff still fed into ultimately a RenderMan final renderer, or
Yes, we were rendering everything inside RenderMan. Everything comes back into Maya, and we light it in our own proprietary lighting interface, which is called Rex, which acts as our bridge between Maya and RenderMan. And so everything always goes back into Rex. It's a very efficient system, which is tightly wrapped around our whole pipeline and the way that we like to work.
The film moves to a climax when Voldemort and Harry obviously confront each other. There's the Ministry stuff. And just before I get to that Hall of Prophecy and such, Voldemort himself really lacks a nose. Mm-hmm. How was that dealt with?
Well, that's NPC's work, that they handle the Voldemort nose replacements, or nose removal, shall we say. So we handled, a total of four shots involving Voldemort. And in each case, the elements of... Actually, no, it was more than that. We did some shots in the Hall of Prophecy. I'd forgotten about those. So NPC would supply us the pre-composited Voldemort nose effect. And this is one of the things, that the way that the Harry Potter production likes to work, is that if you establish a precedent at a facility, so for instance, our first go on Harry Potter was on Prisoner of Azkaban. We did the Hogwarts Express train window composites. So for a couple of films, we would always get the train window work. You know, it's NPC did Voldemort's nose, so that work tends to go to them. The Death Eaters is something that we established in Goblins of Fire, so it was a sort of natural fit for us to then do the Death Eaters on this film.
It's actually great the way the London facilities work together, because it is a huge amount of work, and often, not just on this film but on others, there are time constraint issues, and the ability of the London facilities to work together actually has opened up London for a large amount of production work that maybe it otherwise would have missed out on.
Oh, absolutely. I think right from the very beginning, London has always had to work in a collaborative fashion, because to be able to put together all the effects on a big feature film like Harry Potter was certainly beyond the capabilities of any of the even the largest facilities in London a couple of years ago. I mean, it's true to say now that several of the facilities, I think ourselves included, have grown to a scale where we could probably handle all of the work on a film like Harry Potter and keep it all in one place, you know, do all 1,400 shots in one location. But what that means is it sort of then exposes you to the sort of very much the sort of cyclical hire and fire business that often can go on with, it's associated with big shows. And so by breaking up the shows across different facilities, I think it allows all of the big facilities to then spread the work more evenly across the whole year.
And of course that just benefits the whole industry, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think all of the big facilities have learned to be able to do this now, to be able to spread the work, and thus we can sustain these large teams, and keep our capacity, so we don't have to lose everybody at the end of a big show. We can then roll them onto the next one that's coming in.
Well, now they get back to the Hall of Prophecy and also the Veil Room, because sure. You did some amazing work there. Can you tell me about that?
Well, the Hall of Prophecy is I think, a bit of a departure in Harry Potter, because I think it's the first time that they've ever used a fully virtual set for a whole scene. And the Hall of Prophecy is this big storeroom inside the Ministry of Magic, where the wizards keep all of the various prophecies that have been made over the years by the wizarding population. And the prophecies are, you can almost imagine them as being like a sort of wizarding holographic record of somebody making a prediction about what's going to happen in the future. And these things are stored inside glass spheres, rather like crystal balls or giant fish bowls. And the prophecy itself is a sort of plasma, cum gas, cum fluid sort of thing that exists inside this sphere. And they are almost semi-sentient in a way, that they have a life of their own, these prophecies. They know who they're supposed to be aimed at. They are in continual motion. They have a sort of organic nature to them. And depending on what kind of activity is going on around the prophecies, you know, whether there's, if people are moving rapidly, fighting, if there's there's a lot of agitation nearby, the prophecies respond by emitting light and beginning to glow. And there are hundreds of thousands of these things, millions of these things inside the Hall of Prophecy. The hall itself is like a vast warehouse with shelving going off in all directions and stretching up into the darkness above you, the implication being that the shelves are infinitely high, arranged in very, very closely spaced ranks. So each direction you look in, you just see these corridors receding off into the distance. And it's quite a harsh geometric environment. It's stylistically, it's quite a departure for the world of Harry Potter, which has this sort of very ornate, almost Victorian Dickensian sort of kind of look to it. And as I say, all the shelves are carrying these glass spheres, and the shelves themselves are made out of glass, so it's a very harsh, crystalline environment.
Or at least it was until your DN Dynamite and a Reducto spell kind of
cocked
up the
end.
Tell us about what you did to it.
Well, you see, at an early stage, there was this plan originally to build the Hall of Prophecy as a partial set build, and then we'd extend it digitally. But when they realized the logistics of light the thing, because it's all made out of glass, and putting all these thousands of spheres into place was just going to mean that, you know, if you knock over the shelves, it was going to take 6 weeks to do a reset, which even on the kind of timescales that Harry Potter works on is just absolutely impractical. And we decided for the sake of practicality at a very early stage, just for lighting the set, that it would make much more sense to go digitally with the thing. We then realized, okay, well, now the whole thing's digital, we can do a lot more with this in terms of the destruction moment that happens at the end of the sequence. What it is there's a battle kicks off inside the Hall of Prophecy with the Death Eaters pursuing the kids through the ranks of shelves. And then Ginny Weasley, who has perfected the Reducto spell that she practices earlier on in the Room of Requirements, she basically shoots down the Death Eaters that are pursuing them, which causes an enormous explosion, which then knocks out the lower levels of some of the shelves. Shelves then begin to topple and fall over, and basically go over like a series of giant glass dominoes toppling towards the kids, setting off this chain reaction where everything basically falls over. So we developed our own in-house dynamics toolset called Dynamite, which we've used on a couple of shows previously. We used it actually very extensively on World Trade Center. The way we applied it there was we used it to actually help model Ground Zero, because we used dynamics to scatter debris and geometry across the basic Ground Zero model that we'd actually built. Placing all that geometry by hand was completely impossible. Dynamite is really good because it handles complexity really well. It scales very nicely, much better than Meyer's own native rigid body dynamics toolset actually does. But at the same time, we've got all these huge numbers of very tightly organized assets inside the Hall of Prophecy scenes. You know, all the shells, the prophecy spheres, the stands that they sit on, which are all unique objects. They're all kind of very, very tightly, very, very detailed objects. They're all precisely placed compositionally. The shelving units themselves consist of many separate subcomponents. They've got quite ornate gearing mechanisms which allow them to rise up and down, which you see in one shot, I think, in the film there. Our big challenge there was to combine Dynamite with our asset management system, which we actually developed a couple of years ago to create the big cityscapes in Batman Begins, and which allowed us to manage the incredibly complex geometry there. But it was, you know, those, once we built those cities, they just had to sit there and look beautiful. You know, we'd light them, and that'd be that. But this all had to move, it all had to animate. So there was a lot of R&D was done by our team to integrate Dynamite with our asset management system so that we could make all of the objects in any given scene simulatable, you know, put them into the simulation.
That just strikes me as one heck of a render cycle. I mean, it's beautiful, but long to render.
Yes, they were. The render times were pretty enormous because first off, the sheer complexity of the thing, in terms of just the number of bits of geometry that are in there. You know, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of geometric components in there. I mean, I would joke that each one of the 175 shots in the Hall of Prophecy had the same level of complexity as our big aerial view of Gotham from Batman Begins. And, you know, it wasn't too much of an exaggeration. In fact, I think there were several scenes which had considerably more complexity than those shots from Batman Begins.
Wow.
And, you know, we'd spent the best part of 6 months making one shot for that show. We had to get a lot more efficient in the way that we were putting things together for Goblet of Fire, Order of the Phoenix, sorry. So there were a lot of shading tricks we used because obviously the whole thing's made out of glass and we didn't want to commit to doing, you know, ray tracing this whole thing. That would have been quite complicated, to say the very least. So there was a lot of work done with, lots of shader cheats to give the look of glass, to give reflections, to give refractions. But there's a lot of textural detail on top of that. There's lots of dust, there's cobwebs. The prophecy spheres have these complex volumetric fluids going on inside them as well, which again was a very clever shading cheat put together by one of our shader writers, Chris Magnall, came up with this beautiful, glowing, swirling, plasmatic interior for the prophecies, which looks very much like it's done with fluid dynamics, but it's actually a very, very clever layered shader cheat. But we've got hundreds of thousands of these things, so it all added up. So what we did there was we came up with a sort of two-stage lighting process. We would do as much as we could in 3D, getting the beauty lighting as close as we possibly could to what the finished look should be. But then we rendered out lots and lots of different holdout mats. For every surface pretty much had its own holdout mat, ID mat. You know, you could pick individual spheres and make them brighter, make them darker. We could affect the highlights on the top. We had dust layers. There was lots of separate layers for the ambient lighting, separate layers for the specular components. All of the edges to the shelves had holdout mats that allow us to vary the balance of lighting on one side or another. And then again, we were also rendering depth maps and normal maps, which allowed us to relight the whole thing in 2D after the fact, so we could save on the render cycles. Because, yeah, they would take a long time to go through those shots.
I mean, hearing about it, you know, in the past tense, obviously it sounds very impressive, but did you ever sort of sit in a conference room somewhere with a blank piece of paper and go, well, this isn't going to work if we ray trace, and then sort of blankly look at the paper and think, cripes, how are we going to approach this one?
Well, that was definitely the initial response when I responded very much to the artwork that was coming out of art department, Stuart Craig's design work. It was just absolutely phenomenal. And you just look at these wonderful renderings of what the Hall of Prophecy might look like with all these glittering glass surfaces going off in every direction, these sort of op art perspective tricks where you would see all these different vanishing points within the ranks and ranks of shelves and spheres. And then the practical side of you is saying, hang on, you know, you try and ray trace this, it's going to take a million zillion years. You know, I was talking with people the other day about when I first started doing computer graphics using Amigas, and it would take 32 hours to get a single low resolution frame rendered out of my Amiga 500 back in 1990. And there was part of me who was saying, you're going back there again, you know, regardless of how much hardware you've got in the machinery. But at the same time, you just look at it, and it was just so exciting and so beautiful. You think, well, we've just got to work out a way to do this. And, you know, we've put together a pretty good R&D team. We've got some very good artists at Double Negative these days. So, you know, you just have to rely on the fact that you've got some really clever, really talented people working with you who are going to find a solution to this thing, because they were getting as excited as I was about
it. It must fill you with admiration for your own team when you see a shot like that up on the screen and realize that from that blank piece of paper the guys did pull it off.
Oh god, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing you realize at a very early stage working in visual effects is it is a collaborative medium. It's very difficult for one person to just be the person that does everything. You know, there are still examples of, you know, kind of lone gunmen out there, as it were, who can crank out some amazing stuff. But when you're doing something on this sort of scale, you really do have to rely on the team and the ability of the team to do stuff. And really, you know, my job is just guiding the whole thing. But you always start off with a plan, and then people do stuff, and they quite often they give you stuff you never expected to get. They completely exceed everything that you'd hoped for. And then you say, great, well, now we can do all this stuff as well. So you then you revise your plan and you constantly evolve with it. And I must say, I think certainly those big destruction moments in the Hall of Prophecy are, you know, they exceeded my wildest dreams of what I thought we'd be able to achieve with the level of complexity and also just the sheer creativity that went into those shots.
Because it can't be overestimated, the amount of complexity of just managing that much flexibility and that much those many layers. And you know, you speak of being able to adjust individual shelves or individual items and stuff, but I mean, all of that revolves around mats, which revolves around layers, management of those, updating of databases, you know, countless teams that go into actually sort of pulling something like that off. So you have the flexibility to get it just right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you spend a lot of time planning and testing and experimenting. So you know, the 3D team that did the work on the Hall of Prophecy worked very, very closely with the compositing team, who then put it all together. And you know, the final result is it's as I say, it's very much a collaboration. It's I've always tended to favour in the past the policy of 3D getting the lighting pretty much finished up front, and then 2D can focus on all the other things that make the shot sing. But in this case, you know, the complexity of it, you know, trying to push the machinery to do something which is so heavy, means you can't just approach it like that, and it becomes very much this backwards and forwards thing. And if you don't have really good people thinking about it really hard at every stage, it just isn't going to work. And there are, you know, I can look at shots where I know that it was, you know, you're looking at a shot which is pretty much finished in 3D and then it was put together in 2D, you know, quite simply. But then there's other shots where the 3D, you know, the guys pushed it, but the client was still looking for something else. So you're looking at something which is entirely the product of the 2D process. And then there's all different stages all in between. And the great thing is it all looks the same. It all works as one long continuous sequence. And I think that's what's so impressive.
Now, as the characters escape, they end up in the Veil Room. And I was wondering if you could talk me through some really interesting work that was done at the end of that Veil Room sequence. Basically, obviously not giving anything away because of the book being already out, but Sirius Black, when he's struck down and life leaves his body with a veil in the arch. Can you just talk us about through that?
Sure. Obviously that's the big, it's the big payoff at the end of the Veil Room sequence. And was one of the most talked about moments in the book. I remember when the book was first published, it's you know, the death of Sirius comes as really quite a shock. And so you know, we really wanted to make sure that we got this thing right. And Sirius's death was something that very much evolved through the process of shooting and then through the whole post process after that. Whilst on set, David Yates and Gary Oldman had a number of different thoughts about what should happen to Sirius as he actually dies. And there were various different ideas that you'd see the life being sucked out of him. That was, I think, one of Gary's ideas at an early stage. And they shot a lot of moments where you see Sirius in front of the veil after he's been struck by Bellatrix's spell. She casts the, I can always pronounce this incorrectly, I think the Avada Kedavra spell. It's the green killing, unforgivable spell, I think. And you see this moment, she zaps him with the spell. He takes the hit. The actual moment where he gets hit by the spell is primarily a displacement effect. It's largely created in 2D and compositing, where we wanted something really quite violent. It looked like he'd been slammed by an invisible truck. And so you see his image kind of breaks up and burns out. There is particle and fluid animation in there as well, but it's played down and in much more in favour of the sort of lighting effects. And I'm focusing on Gary's facial expressions, his performance, you know, which sells the fact that he's been struck down by this thing. And then there's a moment where we see him lingering in front of the veil, and basically he's dying. And this comes out of the ideas that David and Gary had on set. And then we wanted to show him going through the veil. And obviously, John Richardson's special effects team on set, they rigged Gary on a wire rig, a zero gravity rig, so he could float up into the air and look like he was being carried away through the archway. And he passes back through the arch. But of course, there's no actual veil in the arch on set. It's just empty. So the veil is a CG effect that we added throughout the whole sequence. And the idea is that the veil is, it's just on the edge of visibility. It's this sort of diaphanous boundary between this world and the next. It was actually based on a series of elements which had been, or tests which had been shot for us by art department of various different materials lit in different ways, shot high speed, pushed around with air movers, which gave these lovely billowing, rippling waves through the cloth. And we recreated that as a cloth simulation in Cyflex. And then there's a series of different shader passes giving us various sort of roll-off effects and things were actually used to create the final look of the veil. But the veil always just, it just pretty much hangs in the archway and blows about in a sort of fairly sort of slow motion kind of way throughout the whole sequence until this moment where we then see the veil reaching forward to embrace Sirius. We wanted this idea that it's not the veil that's killed him. The veil is a dangerous thing. You don't walk through the veil because you'll end up in the afterlife. But it's not the veil that's killed him. It's Bellatrix that's killed him. She's shot him with the killing spell. And the veil senses Sirius dying. So it begins to reach out to fold around him. And that was quite a trick to do, to really sell that idea of the veil reaching round him, embracing him, shrouding him, basically. It's like he's being wrapped up in a winding sheet to be taken down into a tomb.
I was interested to talk about this shot because Gary Oldman's such a good actor, and this is a place where you really don't want to cover up his acting. I mean, it's one thing to have a completely CG shot where it's, you know, things exploding and it's dramatic, but the humanity of his performance is what gives the scene its momentum, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the key things there was that whilst we were selling this idea of the veil wrapping around him, we don't really obscure his face until pretty much the very last moment where he's going back over, he's falling back over and the wire rig is taking him away. So you're very much seeing his face up until that last moment. And we kept as much of Gary's face as possible. We make him ghostly, we're taking away colour, we're beginning to dissolve him away, he's beginning to be blurred and distorted by the veil, but it's still very definitely Gary underneath all that. And in the shots that lead up to this moment, we do things like we drain the colour from his face, we begin to dull his eyes down as well, adding a sort of slight cataract kind of effect to his eyes to really sell the idea that, you know, he's dying, he's going away, he's not coming back.
Do you know if Gary Oldman, I mean, have you heard what Gary Oldman thought of your final shot?
I haven't yet. I hope he liked it. I think it was a pretty good screen there. You know, he got a good moment there, I think.
You know, it's your famous thing, isn't it? Like, your, as an actor, your big death scene, the climax of the film.
Yes.
But it is true that we don't want the CG to get in the way, because we like these characters so much because the actors give us such good performances, and for all the visual effects, we want the two to work in concert, really, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And the Harry Potter films, I hesitate to call them effects-led. I mean, obviously, there's a huge visual effects content in this film. It's 1,400 visual effects shots in total, I believe. And, there mustn't be much more than about 1,900, 2,000 shots in the whole film. So that's, you could definitely say that would qualify as a visual effects-led film. But it's not. It's a story-led film that uses visual effects to tell the story. All the discussions that I see online about the films are always about the characters, what they're doing, the scenes from the stories. And the books are successful because they're cracking good stories. They keep turning the pages. You want to know what happens next to the characters. You care about the characters. And if we can make it, if we can tell that story that much more clearly with the visual effects and make it spectacular and enjoyable at the same time, then that's, then we're doing our jobs properly, I think.
Well, clearly the film is one of the big films to come out in the American summer. It's a major franchise, and your work on it, 950 shots or whatever we discussed at the beginning, is pretty impressive. There was about, what, how many members of the team, how big was it that you got on the project?
Well, I think total there were about probably somewhere in the region of 220 people worked on the project at various times at Double Negative. I think at its height, the team, in terms of its maximum size that it got to at any one point on the show, I think we had 180 people working on it at the same time in the last 2-3 months of post. So it was a big old team. I spent an awful lot of time in dailies in the dark. And I'd hear all these disembodied voices floating out of the darkness behind me. And then later, you know, I'd comment on a shot and somebody would respond to me. And, you know, there were a lot of new faces joining the company to do the work because, when we did Batman Begins, the total size of Double Negative was about 185 people. And we were doing about 8 different projects at that point. DNEG is currently 400 staff. And, half of that crew was working on Harry Potter. So it was always a challenge to get to know the team properly, which I think is always an important thing. And also that you go and speak to people, you know, one-to-one, so they don't just feel like their numbers being shoveled through the dailies machine and getting notes from the publishing system, which we have, which manages all of our shop workflow. So it was quite funny. I'd often ask the producers, I'd say, so who's doing this shot? I need to go and talk to them about it. And they say, well, this is such and such. And I say, well, who's that? And they say, well, you know, he was in dailies. You were talking to him. And I was thinking, well, it's just a voice came out of the darkness. So I did have a good period at the end where I would get to go and actually speak to all the artists one-on-one, which meant an awful lot of running around for me. But that was, you know, keeps you on my toes, keeps you fit.
Well, we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Mike. It's great to speak to you.
Well, thanks for that, guys. Paul, thanks again for taking part in a podcast here at FXI. We consider you one of our friends based upon the really high-quality conversations we've had to you. I still think back to some of those initial Batman ones that we did early on. And again, thanks for taking the time. Once again, be sure to check out our daily netcasts from Seagraph beginning next week. Once again, they're not going to appear on iTunes. You're going to have to visit the site and watch the streaming versions of it, but we'll have a very prominent area where you can download and watch those movies. So bring on the comments. We really hope you enjoy the coverage. I'm going to be heading out there this weekend, and we're going to hit the ground running. Well, that's it for this week. For co-founders Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, I'm John Montgomery. We'll see you online.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.